Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today we have news for you on how water cuts are impacting the desert community of Borrego Springs, and also how penalties just adopted by the Helix Water District could impact you if you're a heavy water user. The controversial Park Station project came before La Mesa's Planning Commission last week, and we'll have the outcome on today's show. The ACLU has launched a cell phone app to help citizens keep law enforcement officers accountable. We'll have details on that, too. Plus, we'll have news about a groper who assaulted a jogger at UCSD. You'll also hear why a court has thrown out restrictions on jail mail imposed on inmates at county detention facilities. On Tribal Beat, hear about a big victory in court for the Hamul Indians over their planned casino. On Green Scene, learn about a major company that's selling off its solar business, including manufacturing here in San Diego. From Public News Service, hear about the growing number of foster children being forced into group homes. And on a more positive note, we'll have news today about a disabled veteran in El Cajon who's getting a brand new home, free thanks to Homes for Our Troops. We have a health warning for you about a salmonella outbreak that's believed linked to sushi. Also hear why Escondido is being sued for discrimination over its handling of immigrant children from Central America. And then on Crime Beat, hear about a shocking murder case in El Cajon. On the second half of our show today, our newsmaker interview is with Leticia Sandoval from Stronger Communities. That's a nonprofit that's just moved into El Cajon. She'll be talking about services that are now available to help people with a wide variety of problems right here in East County. We've got some good economic news on joblessness in our region, but also some troubling news about a trend that could take away vacations on certain public lands. On Bookshelf, we'll be replaying Raina Menashe's interview with author Antonio Villano, and then we'll have details for you on a new law to help veterans with tuition, even if they move to a different state. We'll have all these stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. An emergency order issued by Governor Jerry Brown is having a harsher impact on some communities than others, since the slash water use requirements make no distinction between northern forested communities and places like Borrego Springs, which is located in the Anza Borrego Desert. Brett Hart, president of Borrego's Water District Board, stated at a recent public meeting that the governor's order means Borrego would have to either limit irrigation to 2 days a week or cut municipal use by 25%, the Borrego Sun reports. Noting the dire potential consequences, he added, "Clearly we are not willing to devastate our valley by destroying all the vegetation here, so our option is to reduce water usage by 25%. That's a tough challenge in a place where golf courses are the lifeblood for tourism. What happens if Borrego fails to meet the state's goal is not yet clear," Hart told residents of the desert community, where summer temperatures can reach 120 degrees or more, and thirsty plants need water every day. The town is also struggling with an even graver problem, draining down its groundwater more rapidly than rainwater has replenished it. The community is working on a sustainable groundwater plan to address the overdraft problem, but for now, Hart worries that drought orders from the state could create a crisis for our community, he says. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Heavy water users in the Helix Water District will soon be paying more. The district's board voted 4-1 to adopt a drought action plan that limits outdoor watering to just 2 days a week and assesses penalties on Tier 3 householders, the largest water users. Those that use more than 30 units of water during the two-month billing cycle will pay a 10% penalty on the excess water, starting with water bills arriving in late July. So how much does this cost consumers? A person who exceeds the limit by just 1 unit of water would pay 55 cents, but someone who uses 100 units, over triple the allotment, would pay $38 in penalties. And if you used 150 units, nearly five times the limit, you'd pay $66. Average water use in the district is 26 units per billing cycle, but many residents voiced anger the district failed to take into account family size or lot size. It's simply unrealistic to expect a homeowner with a couple of acres to use the same amount of water as an urban resident with a small lot that's mostly paved. There is, however, a variance procedure, district spokesman Mike Erhammer told East County Magazine. Residents can request and potentially be granted a variance if they can show undue hardship. Variances may be granted for those who need to irrigate slopes to prevent erosion or green belts for defensive space against wildfires. Erhammer said parks and schools have been exempted from the order. The district can also impose fines on people who waste water, such as running sprinklers when it's raining or allowing large amounts of water to run off into the street. The board's drought plan also cuts warnings before fines are imposed from 3 to just 1. Fines start at $100 and can be up to $500 for a third offense. The drought plan was adopted in response to an executive order issued by Governor Jerry Brown ordering all water agencies to slash water use. Helix objected to the state treating all agencies the same, regardless of climate, evaporation rate, or lot sizes, but thus far, those objections have fallen on deaf ears. If you need help figuring out how to cut your water use, you can call the Helix Water District and request a free assessment of your indoor and outdoor water use. The visit also includes checking for leaks and recommendations on ways you can save water. There are also rebates for items ranging from a rain barrel to removing turf. Even if rebates run out, Erhammer advises calling back since new rebates are being added. Helix is the first water district in San Diego County to adopt penalties for heavy water users. The vote was 4-1, with Director Joel Scalzetti voting against the measure. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
Last week, the controversial Park Station project came before La Mesa's Planning Commission for the third time. The commission voted to deny approval, finding the project inconsistent with the city's general plan and community objectives. But the commission approved the environmental impact report, so next up, the transit-friendly development will come before the La Mesa City Council, which will ultimately determine the fate of Park Station. The original plan called for an 18-story high-rise mixed-use facility adjacent to the historic downtown village. The latest revised plan was dramatically scaled down to a maximum of 6 stories, or 75 feet high, dropping to 4 stories in some areas. But that's still far over the 46-foot height limit citywide, plus the developer wanted double the density allowed anywhere else in La Mesa, a higher density than even the controversial One Paseo project in Carmel Valley. The new plan eliminated a park from an earlier proposal, but added a hotel, including event space and a grand ballroom, an attraction supported by the La Mesa Chamber of Commerce. Senior housing, dining, and shopping options would also be added. However, the revised plan slashed the amount of parking to just 1.25 spaces per residential unit, a shift that drew opposition from neighbors. Perhaps the most controversial aspect is the developer's effort to get a specific plan that would apply only to Park Station, exempting the project from zoning requirements in the downtown district and the rest of La Mesa. The developer seeks a by-right declaration to make future changes without city approval in what critics called a blank check. Sherman Harmer from Urban Housing Partners spoke on behalf of the developers, insisting that the project would have a small-town feel. Developer Frank Kitzman said 75% of the surrounding properties are commercial, retail, and office space. Numerous citizens spoke on both sides of the issue. Mary England, president of the La Mesa Chamber of Commerce, called the project a gateway to the city and voiced enthusiasm to hold events at Park Station. Residents opposed to the project objected to waiving rules for Park Station, voicing concerns over traffic, parking congestion, and the prospect of unacceptable changes being made by the developer without another public hearing under the by-right decree. Larice Girk objected to issuing the developer a blank check, likening it to giving your okay with clouds in the air. Harmer later told East County Magazine that the specific plan has 100 pages of accountability in his view. In heated testimony, resident Jim Whitney accused the Kitzmans of not caring about the village. Craig Maxwell, owner of Maxwell's House of Books, argued that the historic downtown village should be protected. It's the jewel of the city, he said. All 6 commissioners present voted to approve the EIR, with 1 absent. But when it came time to vote on the project itself, 4 of the 6 voted to deny approval. The measure will next proceed to the City Council, which includes 3 members who want office with backing from the pro-business and pro-development Lincoln Club. That includes two new faces on the council, and one of them, Bill Baber, is a registered lobbyist for the construction industry. Whether La Mesa's council members will back the major development project, or whether Baber may recuse himself to avoid a conflict of interest perception, remains to be seen. So the fate of Park Station in La Mesa is far from sealed. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The ACLU of California has launched Mobile Justice California, a free smartphone app allowing Californians to automatically record and submit cell phone videos to their ACLU affiliate when they feel law enforcement officers are violating civil rights. Videos captured on the Mobile Justice California app, available for use on Android and iPhones, will be transmitted to the ACLU and preserved even if the user's phone is later seized or destroyed. Norma Chavez-Peterson, executive director for the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial Counties, states, "The concerns over police practices, including racial profiling and excessive use of force, are very real for communities across the state. This app will help serve as a check on abuse, whether by police officers, sheriff's deputies, border patrol, or other officials, allowing ordinary citizens to record and document any interaction with law enforcement." Mobile Justice California can be downloaded free through Apple's App Store or Google Play. It enables users to register, record, witness, and report interactions with law enforcement, and also includes information on individual rights when stopped by law enforcement. Besides allowing an individual to record exchanges with law enforcement officers and automatically transmit the video to the ACLU, it also sends out a witness alert to anyone else with the app, giving them the option to go to the location and document the encounter when police stop someone. The app user can also complete an incident report to send the ACLU for review. The Ella Baker Center is partnering with the ACLU of California to support the launch of the Mobile Justice California app, broadening community organizations and community members' engagement with the app. Patrice Cullors, director of the Truth and Reinvestment Campaign at the Ella Baker Center, says, "People who historically have had very little power in the face of law enforcement now have this tool to reclaim their power and dignity. Our vision is that this app will ultimately help community members connect and organize to respond to incidents of law enforcement violence and then share their experiences and knowledge with others." The ACLU's Director of Police Practices, Peter Bibring, notes that from Rodney King to Walter Scott, we've seen video bring police abuse into public view that otherwise could have gone ignored. Helping the public record law enforcement will help deter misconduct and document abuse when it does happen, so both officers and the criminal justice system can be held accountable. While Mobile Justice California is intended for use by bystanders, the ACLU of California recognizes that some users may want to use it while they are involved in a police encounter. Anyone interacting with law enforcement should announce that they are reaching for a phone and that they are attempting to access the app to record the exchange. Users' safety depends on their ability to clearly communicate any actions they take and remain calm, the ACLU emphasizes. The ACLU of California will be working with community organizations to provide Know Your Rights trainings on how to use the app, as well as basic rights related to interactions with law enforcement. Groups are encouraged to contact the ACLU to set up a training class. A grant from Susan Adelman and Claudio Llanos allowed the ACLU of California to develop the Mobile Justice California app. For more information on the Mobile Justice California app, including a video, frequently asked questions, and one-page overview of how to use the app, please see www.mobilejusticeca.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Ed Barrena.
An alert has been issued to students at the University of California San Diego campus after a man groped a jogger near campus on Tuesday night at 10 p.m., Police are seeking the suspect, who is described as a Hispanic man in his late 20s, approximately 5 feet 5 inches tall. He wore red shorts and a black T-shirt. Times of San Diego reports that the victim told police the man approached her from behind and groped her as she ran in the vicinity of La Jolla Village and La Jolla Scenic Drives. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You've heard of snail mail, but what about jail mail? Back in 2012, San Diego Sheriff Bill Gore sought to stop drugs and weapons from being smuggled into county jails in envelopes, so the sheriff imposed a ban on mail to inmates, allowing only postcards or emails, no handwritten letters from loved ones. An exception was allowed for inmates to receive letters from their attorneys, however, But now a federal judge has ordered the sheriff to suspend enforcement of the postcard-only policy by May 21st. The ruling by U.S. District Court Judge Lorenz comes in response to a lawsuit filed by Prison Legal News, which alleged that the policy violated the First and 14th Amendments to the Constitution. Prison Legal News filed suit in 2014 after the Sheriff's Department refused to deliver Prison Legal News to San Diego County jails after the postcard policy was imposed. NBC News reports that Sheriff's spokesperson Jan Caldwell says the department is in the process of reinstating the mail procedure we had prior to the postcard-only policy. So local inmates will soon be able to receive love letters and other correspondence that's been banned for the past 3 years. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is Leon Thompson with the Tribal Beat Report from East County Magazine on KNSJ, where East County matters. U.S. District Judge Kimberly Mueller rejected an activist group's motion to preemptively halt construction on the proposed Hollywood-themed casino on the Hamul Indian Village land. The 19-page opinion reads, "Conclusion, the motion is denied. It is so ordered." Dated May 15, 2015. The principal plaintiff, the Hamul Action Committee, has a history of impeding, challenging, and attempting to block the construction of the casino since its inception. Raymond Hunter, chairman of the nationally recognized Hamul Indian Tribe, had this to say, "We are pleased that Judge Mueller recognized that the Hamul Action Committee's lawsuit had no merit and recognized that sanctions may be in order for the future. This is just the latest in a string of more than two dozen frivolous lawsuits lost by a small number of individuals trying to deny our rights to economic independence. An overwhelming majority of the community supports our project and the approximately 1,000 permanent jobs it will create in East County. We continue to work with county officials on an intergovernmental agreement to provide funding for fire protection services and traffic mitigation, among other things, and look forward to the opening of Hollywood Casino Hamul next year." The Kumeyaay Nation of Southern California can be traced back 10,000 years. The Hamul Indian Village is one of 13 bands of the Kumeyaay Nation federally recognized as sovereign. These are the people who greeted Juan Cabrillo in San Diego Bay in 1524. The Hamul Action Committee is a nonprofit group founded in the 1980s to oppose a proposed quarry. The Hamul Action Committee Board is disappointed by the ruling, but remains confident that compelling legal arguments exist to continue the fight, Hamul Action Committee President Glenn Revelle said. "We can accept the final ruling and give in to the suggestion that the proposed casino is a done deal, or we can place our faith and support in the compelling legal position that will ultimately stop this project forever." Revelle said the group's counsel stands ready to immediately appeal. The judge also denied the plaintiff's request for a preliminary injunction to halt construction, saying the federal government doesn't have the authority to do any such thing on tribal lands. The judge emphatically denied the group's motion for a writ of mandate and preliminary injunction seeking to force the National Indian Gaming Commission to do an environmental review and block construction of the proposed casino. The National Indian Gaming Commission's mission is to promote tribal economic development, self-sufficiency, strong tribal governments, and ensuring that tribes are the primary beneficiaries of their gaming activities, not to arrest private casino construction projects on reservation land before any gaming activities have taken place, the judge said. In addition to going after federal authorities, the plaintiff's suit names as defendants the chairman of the Hamul Indian Village, several tribal council members, and the tribe's development partners on the casino project. All 27 lawsuits, motions, and attacks aimed at halting the casino have failed. over a decade of delays has not made it any easier to care for tribal members, from grandparents to school children and everything in between. The tiny 6-acre Jamul Indian Village's most valuable asset is its proximity to San Diego and the Mexican border crossings at Otay and Tecate. The tribe and their leaders have chosen to build an enterprise that they believe will benefit its members and the community of Jamul. To read U.S. District Judge Kimberly Mueller's 19-page opinion, go to eastcountymagazine.org and click on the link at the bottom of the article. For more information, go to the Tribal Beat section on our website.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community. This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. Soytech launched its solar manufacturing facility in San Diego with a $25 million federal grant, touting its cutting-edge, utility-scale solar collectors as ultra-efficient. But now, the French-based company has announced it is selling off most of its solar assets, including its manufacturing facility in Rancho Bernardo. The buyer is Consen Solar. The deal includes all technology assets, manufacturing operations in Germany and San Diego, according to a company press release. The company sought to build four massive solar facilities in Rural Boulevard, two of which were approved by county supervisors despite strong community opposition due to destruction of meadows and wetlands, as well as depletion of groundwater, among other issues. Soytech later announced it was selling one of those projects. The fate of the remaining project remains unclear, as does the future of the Rancho Bernardo facility's employees. Soytech's problems were caused primarily by the plummeting price of solar panels offered by competitors, which cost the company key contracts. Soytech says it will continue to develop and bring to market a four-junction solar cell or a smart cell, the company reports.
Too many of California's foster children are stuck in group homes when they should be placed with a loving family. That's according to a new report released today called Kids Count, Every Kid Needs a Family, giving children in the child welfare system the best chance for success. The report, funded by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, says California has almost 57,000 foster kids, and only 83% of them are in family-like settings. Researcher Jessica Minich says the institutional feeling of group homes makes it hard for children to feel connected.
All children need a stable, loving home. They need those lifelong connections, people who are there to support them emotionally. And when children enter the foster care, that stability is often disrupted.
The report praises California's Continuum of Care Reform Project, which looks for ways to improve the system. They have launched initiatives to keep kids out of foster care in the first place by assisting families in crisis, addressing the stressors that can lead to child neglect. Minich says financial problems are often a factor.
A lot of times that coincides with poverty. You can't afford child care, diapers, formula. So making sure that families are tapped into all the resources they need to help provide those basic needs for children.
The report also looked at best practices around the nation. For example, in Washington, D.C., they have a rapid response team that can certify relatives' homes very quickly to minimize disruption in kids' lives when they have to be removed from their parents' care. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Marine Corporal Carlos Torres lost both of his legs when he stepped on an improvised explosive device, or IED, while serving in Afghanistan in 2011. He also seriously injured his elbow. Despite his devastating injuries, Corporal Torres fought back, regaining an active lifestyle. He ran the Marine Corps Marathon 10K in 2013 and plays wheelchair basketball. He also participates in fishing, cycling, tennis, surfing, and scuba diving. Now, thanks to Homes for Our Troops, he will soon have a specially adapted home of his own in El Cajon. The East County, California reports that Homes for Our Troops has broken ground and the new house is under construction and slated for completion this fall. The home will be given to Torres with no mortgage. The one-story home will include a roll-in shower, roll-under countertops, as well as sinks, appliances, and other features built for accessibility. Homes for Our Troops has built 187 adaptive homes for severely injured veterans and has 49 more under construction nationwide. Torres looks forward to moving in with other family members soon and doing a lot more cooking. Receiving help from Homes for Our Troops is going to be a blessing and will allow for better living conditions, he says. Thank you for the freedom this home represents. You can find more information about Homes for Our Troops at hfotusa.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Leon Thompson.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health warning. 7 San Diego residents and 2 visitors to our county have been diagnosed with infections from a rare form of salmonella after eating raw fish or sushi, the County Health and Human Services Agency announced Friday. The 9 cases are part of a multi-state outbreak of salmonella, which has sickened 53 people in 9 states, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. There have been no deaths, but 10 people have been hospitalized. Most of the people who've gotten sick live in or recently traveled to the southwestern United States. Investigations by the CDC, the County Health Department in San Diego, and health departments in other areas have not conclusively identified a food source, but nearly all of the ill people reported eating sushi containing raw fish in the week before becoming ill, and many reported eating spicy tuna sushi. Dr. Wilma Wooten, County Public Health Officer, advises anyone with salmonella symptoms such as nausea, diarrhea, fever, and abdominal cramping, especially after eating raw ground tuna, should seek medical attention promptly. The CDC estimates that salmonella causes 1 million illnesses in the U.S. each year, with 19,000 hospitalizations and 380 deaths. Illness from salmonella lasts about 4 to 7 days, and most people do recover without treatment. Although salmonella is not common in raw fish, consumption of raw or undercooked meats and seafood can cause foodborne illnesses, including salmonella. The most common sources of infection are undercooked poultry, eggs, and meat. Pet birds, turtles, and reptiles can also transmit salmonella. To prevent the illness, wash your hands thoroughly with soap and water before preparing or eating food. Salmonella can be killed by cooking foods to an internal temperature of 165 degrees Fahrenheit. People at higher risk for serious foodborne illness should not eat raw fish or raw shellfish, regardless of an ongoing outbreak, health officials advise. And those groups include children younger than 5 years old, adults older than 65 years of age, pregnant women, people with weakened immune systems, and those with low acid levels in the stomach. For more information about salmonella, you can visit the CDC or the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's websites and check their salmonella pages.
The American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit in federal court against the city of Escondido on May 19th, alleging discrimination against children fleeing violence and persecution in Central America. The suit claims the city trumped up zoning and land use claims as a pretext to deny shelter to the immigrant children. David Loy, legal director of the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial County, states, "This is what 21st century discrimination looks like. Whatever the personal beliefs of individual officials, the city of Escondido capitulated to discrimination and xenophobia and unlawfully denied a home to traumatized children." The ACLU is joined in the lawsuit by lawyers, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and by the law firm of Bancart, Bancart & Cooley, LLP. In February 2014, Southwest Key Programs asked Escondido about potential locations to house unaccompanied children awaiting placement with parents, relatives, or other caregivers already in the United States while their immigration cases were pending. As required by law, the federal government contracts with Southwest Key and other entities to provide housing for children fleeing from violence and persecution in countries like El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. Southwest Key is the largest licensed provider of housing for such children in the United States. Many of these children ultimately qualify for asylum or legal status, allowing them to remain in the United States. Southwest Key already successfully operates such housing facilities in San Diego County and elsewhere around the country. When, at the request of the federal government, Southwest Key sought to add a facility in San Diego County, it determined Escondido had the most suitable properties available, but it ran into a firestorm of opposition led by Escondido Mayor Sam Abed. Southwest Key first sought to convert a motel site in a commercial zone to housing for unaccompanied children. But city staff rejected that proposal, despite the fact that the municipal code expressly allowed residential care facilities in that zone. Attempting to work with the city, Southwest Key agreed to suspend an appeal from that decision and instead pursued a conditional use permit to convert a former skilled nursing facility in a residential zone in another part of the city. But Mayor Abed publicly opposed that project too, and then said he didn't want the facility anywhere in Escondido. Members of the public also complained about the project's potential impact on the character of the neighborhood. The Planning Commission then unanimously rejected the proposal despite a staff's report, which found Southwest Key would bring 90 new jobs and inject $6 or $7 million a year in new revenue into the community and would not impose any significant adverse effects. The project was also enthusiastically endorsed by the mayor of Youngstown, Arizona, where Southwest Key has a similar facility to that proposed for Escondido. And Southwest Key's proposal was rejected despite the fact that the Planning Commission had approved numerous applications to expand a skilled nursing facility that previously occupied the same site. Soon after, the Planning Commission and City Council amended the Escondido zoning code to prohibit residential care facilities in the commercial zone where the motel sites are located. The City Council held a hearing on Southwest Key's appeal on October 2014. Opposing the appeal, members of the public proclaimed, "We don't want these people in our neighborhood," the ACLU's press release states. Joseph Rich, co-director of the Fair Housing and Community Development Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, says that similar statements have been found by many courts to be coded language for unlawful actions that support discrimination and violations of the Fair Housing Act and other civil rights. The City Council voted 4-1 to deny Southwest Key's appeal. Mayor Abed noted that half the city is Hispanic, adding, "Now, do we need more? I don't think so." The lawsuit charges the city of Escondido with depriving children from Central America of housing based on race, color, national origin, ancestry, immigration status, and or hostility to federal policy in violation of federal and state fair housing laws and the United States Constitution. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. Sheriff's deputies have arrested a man for the beating death of his mother on Monday in unincorporated El Cajon. Deputies responded to a call reporting an assault May 17th, shortly after 5 p.m. on Hidden Crest Drive. According to Lieutenant John Marion with the Sheriff's Homicide Detail, investigators believe the victim's 34-year-old son severely physically assaulted his mother and then assaulted his older brother, too. The brother was able to get away and call 911 for help. Deputies and paramedics found the woman suffering trauma to her upper body. CPR was initiated, and she was transported to a hospital where, despite life-saving efforts by hospital personnel, she died. The suspect was later found in the city of El Cajon and placed under arrest, charged with murder. The names of the victim and suspect are being withheld pending a positive identification by the medical examiner and notification of family.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. My very special guest today is Leticia Sandoval, and she is the CEO of Stronger Communities, which is a nonprofit in El Cajon with a mission to improve the quality of life for Southern California residents, especially the at-risk and underserved individuals in our communities. Leticia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me today and for letting me come on here and speak about Stronger Communities.
Now, you're a nonprofit. When did you get started, and what was the reason for founding this organization?
We actually started this nonprofit organization my mother did in 2001 out of Imperial County. And about 4 years ago, as I was working in law enforcement and everything, I realized that East County lacked a lot of services.
Very true. We've certainly noticed that in our years of reporting, that so often people have to go all the way into San Diego, and yet there's no transportation, no mass transit to speak of in much of the East County area. So what are some of the types of services that you offer?
All of these services that I'm going to speak about, we offer it to juveniles and adults.
Okay.
So we offer anger management, anti-theft classes, parenting. We offer graffiti classes, victim impact, financial literacy. We offer text and cell phone classes for driver's distraction violations. We offer also juvenile drug diversion, domestic violence education, and defer entry of judgment classes as well.
Very good. Now, who can qualify for help through your organization at Stronger Communities?
If you can breathe and walk and anything else, you're welcome at Stronger Communities. Anybody, any individual who needs our services, whether they're self-referred or refer from someone else, you're welcome at Stronger Communities.
Okay, so you don't have to be low income or a resident of El Cajon or East County for that matter?
No, you don't have to be low income or resident of El Cajon. We'll take any San Diego County resident.
Now, are these services free or is there a charge? How does that work?
A lot of these services are individual base paid. We also offer scholarship for those individuals that are below the low poverty line, and we'll offer discounts as well. As there's situations where we have that 18 to 22 year-old group that sometimes was in foster care, mm-hmm. and that don't have a lot of money, we'll also offer them scholarships to get the services that they need.
Now, what do you offer for foster kids or kids coming out of foster care as they turn 18?
Some of them will need this kind of classes, and they can't get it because they have to pay for it. If they come into Stronger Communities, we will offer them a scholarship and reduce majority of the cost for the classes.
Very nice. Now, what about people who've been victims of crimes, domestic violence, or merchants that maybe are having trouble with things like shoplifting? I understand you have some things that you can do for these sorts of folks, too.
We do. For domestic violence or any kind of victims that need a temporary restraining order, come into our office. We'll help you fill them out. We'll help you get down to the courthouse and how to file them and everything else. We're there to help out the community, whether it's on one side or the other side of the line. Another thing is for shoplifting, yes, we do have classes in shoplifting, and it's a very...
Meaning not how to shoplift, but how to prevent
shoplifting. How to prevent shoplifting, yes. And we help them identify triggers as to why they do it, what gets them there, the cost, the impact to... not just that store, but the community at large, the police, the courts, and everything else. It's a huge amount of money that goes into preventing a shoplifter to shoplift again.
Very good. Now, you're located in El Cajon at 201 South Sunshine Avenue, which is just a couple of blocks from the courthouse, by the way. So I understand that you also offer translators in certain languages for people who may not be proficient in the English language. What languages do you have interpreters in? For example, do you offer translation services in Spanish, Aramaic, or Arabic?
Arabic and Spanish are also languages that we offer classes in. Right now, we have a Spanish educators in all gamuts of the classes that we offer, the Chaldean population, everything else. We haven't had a lot of requests for that, so once we get that in, we have interpreters on standby to take over and interpret in those classes.
Can you give us some examples of success stories of people that you have actually been able to help through Stronger Communities and what a difference it's made in their lives?
One of our most recent one we had was a young biotech individual who I would not name the company, but had a very much an anger issue at work. Every time he walked into work, I guess it just spiked up his anger and his rage. So he used to fight a lot at work. And he was referred to us by his employer, and he came to us and everything.
Nice.
And after, with him, had to be a 16-hour class. We sat down for 16 hours, and at the end of the class, he was elated to understand his trigger points and everything else, how the anger works and how he needs to control and do other things. It's given them the tools to learn and to self-manage themselves. And he was able to do that, and now he actually wants to come in and volunteer for our business, which is great.
That's wonderful. Very good. Any other examples that you'd like to share with us today?
Yes, we've also helped out agricultural workers in El Centro and Imperial County with Safe and Drinkable Water Act. We've also helped out with the Burn Institute in Imperial County. We've also helped out with the El Centro Regional Medical Center in asthma and diabetes and all that. So we've had a lot of success stories in the background. We have helped thousands of individuals. We want to come into San Diego and we want to come into El Cajon and help out individuals where there's a necessity for certain programs.
Very, very good. And I understand that in El Centro, for example, the water program you mentioned, that you were actually teaching the supervisors of the farm workers how to test the water to see if it was safe because of all the pesticide residues out there.
That's correct. One of the biggest concerns that they had in agriculture was individuals just drinking water that was there. And we all know that there's a lot of pesticides that go into the vegetables and the farming that goes out there. And they didn't know that the water they were drinking had a bunch of pesticides.
Are there any specific problems here in El Cajon or East County that people have brought to you that were of special concern here in East County?
You know, we have not had individuals come in. We moved into the El Cajon market about, 2 months ago.
Oh, so it's brand new.
So it's brand new in the El Cajon market. And so we welcome. Come in. Tell us what's going on. Tell us if you see something that affects a group of individuals, a group of a community members, anything else. We'll try to get involved. I mean, our thing is to make this community much safer and building communities much stronger with each other.
Very good. Do you help individuals who may be having problems with things like navigating, getting social services, for example, or housing issues, those sorts of things?
We do. We are involved with multiple groups and committees that some of them help out with housing and transportation. And then we also get involved with helping individuals, in the welfare systems, helping them fill out their application, telling them what they need to do, what they need to bring, walk them through the steps and everything else. We know that's a very convoluted system. And individuals get frustrated. There's so much they have to jump through just to get to the front door.
Yeah, I've tried helping, an individual, a friend of mine, qualify for food stamps and Medicaid and some of these things. It's very complicated and very, very frustrating. I think the average person would probably just give up after a while. It's so difficult.
And the average wait in that office it's all day.
Yeah.
Because you got to fill the application, turn it in, and then come back later and then have an appointment that same day.
And that's if you can get there. If you don't have a car, what are you supposed to do? What kind of transportation help are you able to offer? I'm curious.
We don't have transportation help in having vans to go pick up individuals, but right in front of our office is a bus stop, and we actually got that office because of the bus stop, because we want to make easy accessible for individuals, especially in East County, to get to us and get to the services they need.
So the office again is at 201 South Sunshine Avenue in El Cajon. How else can people find you? Can you give us your website and phone number, please?
Yes, we are also on the web. It's www.strongercommunitiesca.com. We're also, the phone number is 619-312-2451. Look us up, call us. You can email us through our website as well. We have an email link that you can call us directly. We answer the phone at any time. We'll call you even on the weekends.
Very good. And I see there's also Stronger Communities on Facebook. If you don't remember the rest of that, you can find them there.
Absolutely. We're there. Thank you very much.
Very good. And again, listeners, Stronger Communities is a nonprofit organization. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know today, Letitia, about Stronger Communities that I haven't already asked you about?
No, I think you hit everything. We're just, we're looking forward to meeting a lot of you guys. Say hi to us. Come in and see us. We're new in your neighborhood, and we're here to help.
Very good. Thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
In a sign that the economy is improving, San Diego's unemployment rate last month dropped to 4.8%. That's the lowest in the past 8 years, according to the California Employment Development Department. San Diego is doing better than the state and the nation. Statewide, California's unemployment rate is 6.1%, while the nationwide rate is 5.1%. The most jobs gained locally were in leisure, hospitality, and financial services industries, while construction cut 700 jobs. More gains in recent years have been added in technical, scientific, and professional fields, as well as restaurants, administrative, and support services, each adding thousands of jobs to the local economy. A total of 74,300 people in San Diego remain without work, according to the state's figures. This has been Leon Thompson on East County Magazine.
Vacationing in the Sierra Nevada, California desert, or other public lands could change dramatically if the push to turn federal lands over to state control succeeds. Jamie Williams, president of the Wilderness Society, is issuing the warning and says allowing state control would lock up lands for private development and other parcels would be sold by states to pay for managing additional land.
Well, this is a terrible idea that is totally out of sync with the way Americans value our parks, our forests, and wildlife refuges. They don't want to see their lands turned over to states and sold to the highest bidder.
Williams says the push to privatize public lands originates with special interests and their allies in Congress and could bring the biggest changes to lands in the West. Backers of the idea claim the states would be better managers of federal properties and say there's a legal precedent for state control. Professor John Leshy at the University of California, Hastings, says there's a long history of court decisions affirming the federal government's rights to hold land and that this type of case would probably be laughed out of court.
It has nothing to do with the law, and it's not a legal claim. It's all about politics. I mean, it's all about stirring up the base, tapping into the anxiety or hatred or whatever you want to call it that some people have about federal ownership of land in the West.
Williams says the move for state seizure of public lands is overshadowing the urgent need to reauthorize the Land and Water Conservation Fund, an important program that helps pay for parks, trails, baseball fields, and more in just about every county in the country.
For 50 years, this program has played an essential role in protecting places people love and getting Americans outdoors.
The LWCF expires at the end of September unless Congress takes action. This is Lori Abbott, California News Service.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Antonio F. Viana, author and educator. My guest has written 20 books and 6 screenplays since 2003. He's also created 3 popular workshops: Re-careering at Any Age, How to Write a Book and Get Published, and How to Write a Screenplay. Welcome, Antonio. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for inviting me.
You have written 18 novels and 2 nonfiction books in a period of 10 years, and yet you also work as instructor and area chair of business at the University of Phoenix here in San Diego. How do you find the time and the motivation to write so much and on such a variety of themes?
To me, it's all about commitments and priorities. I mean, essentially, I do what I value in my life and where I want to spend my time. Uh-huh. This means that I don't do a lot of things, but I rather do a few things that I try to do very well, like being an expert. And my life is a 24/7 life because I can write any time during the day or evening or any time during the week. I can control what I do, and I really, really like that. So I do what I do because I want to become good at it and not become a generalist.
So you have to cut back on leisure activities.
I come back on a lot of leisure activities and a lot of sleep because there's only 24 hours in this day to be able to do what I want to do.
So in a typical day, how many hours do you write?
I'll schedule my hours for the whole week, probably on a Sunday. So yesterday I looked at my calendar and asked myself, what are my projects for this whole week? Mm-hmm. And I've got essentially 2 projects going on in the area of writing. And I'll look at probably 2 or 3 hours each day committed to some form of writing or editing or researching in the projects that I'm working on.
Very organized. You've been called a prime example of someone who's re-careered himself. I mean, I know that in your former life, you were an Air Force officer and human resources executive. So how did you transition from that to author?
I was working in Northern California, specifically San Francisco, with a professional medical group, and I was the chief HR executive. Mm-hmm. But I felt at a point in time that I needed to switch. I had what I call the itch to switch. And I think everybody develops the itch sometime in their career,
right,
whether it's at 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, or whatever. But I developed the itch. But I really didn't know what I wanted to do if I had left, changed the human resources executive role. So like any good business person, I did an inventory of who I was and what I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And so I analyzed my skills and my strengths and my weaknesses and my passions and all the things that go into sort of a self-evaluation. Mm-hmm. And I figured that I could do a couple of things very well outside of corporate life. And there was one thing that I was petrified of doing that I thought it could become a developmental opportunity for me. So I gave myself the title of ACE. ACE.
Okay.
A stands for author, C stands for career coach, and E stands for educator. I could be a career coach and educator pretty easily, but I really was petrified of writing. So writing became my developmental opportunity that I decided to commit to. And today, 10 years later, I'm really spending most of my time doing the writing. So it was a business plan that I created. And I considered myself to be the business, and I needed to figure out how I could make money as me, as that person who runs the business.
So if we could say that some writers are born and some are made, you made yourself.
I made myself. I was not an avid writer or an avid reader in the day. In fact, even today, I don't do a lot of reading of full books. I do reading for purposes of research and for looking at how writers are able to tell a compelling story or develop compelling characters.
Craft. Well, I know you've written novels in a variety of genres, books on espionage, murder, love stories, ghost stories, and even a vampire trilogy. Which book did you enjoy the most writing, and why? And is it difficult to cross types of books?
Yeah, I'm always asked this question about what my favorite book is. And so I will answer that in a sort of circular way. I have two favorite books. One is my first book. It's called The Tale from a Ghost Dance. I had no idea what I was doing when I was writing this book. I was experimenting with my writing style. I was experimenting with creating stories and characters. And it's probably, although the book is still in print, it is the worst crafted book of all time.
If you do say so yourself.
If I do say so myself, but I love it because I look at the books that I'm writing now and I can see the growth that I have been able to accomplish in my writing career. So my second favorite book will always be my last book, because it shows what I'm really capable of doing. And that last book is called Scarlet Rose, and it just came out in January of this year.
I know that you've published independently, like so many authors are choosing to do in this new age. What made you go that route, and how do you market yourself?
I'm a control freak. I want to control what I do, and I want to own what I do. And the way to do that for me is look at independent publishing. So I'm with a print-on-demand publisher called Author Solutions. Essentially, I give them my manuscript, and I tell them what to do, how to put it into a book format. I then pay them services for marketing, for editing, for all kinds of things that I would have to pay someone else to do if I was even with a traditional publisher. So the notion of independent publishing allows me to control what I want to do and market it in a way that I think is appropriate. And also, because I now do screenplays, because I own the novel, I can adapt that novel to a screenplay without asking permission from anyone.
Right. And do you have any screenplays that are being optioned?
I have six screenplays now being looked at in Hollywood. Five of them are adapted from my novels. The sixth one, which is called Desperate, that just came out probably a month ago, is an original screenplay. And the idea is to leverage the novel and the screenplay towards Hollywood.
One last question, Antonio. What are you writing now, and when will it be available?
I'm completing a novel called Crush. It's a suspense drama thriller novel. It's about telemarketing scams and how this person overcomes a telemarketing scam. It probably will come out in January of next year.
Okay, look forward to it. Our time is up, but thanks again for joining us. For more information on Antonio F. Viana, please visit his website at www.vianabooks4u.com, and that's the number 4 and the letter U. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you've been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is Leon Thompson with some good news for California veterans and family members seeking an education. The United States Department of Veterans Affairs has announced that all veterans and dependents using the GI Bill benefits shall receive temporary in-state tuition status through the end of the year, regardless of their state of residence. Keith Boylan, CalVets Deputy Secretary for Veterans Services, says the action ensures that students using GI benefits in California are able to continue training at their chosen institutions and receive in-state tuition status. The policy impacts veterans and dependents who enroll in all institutions within 3 years of the veteran's qualifying discharge. Bob McDonald is Secretary of Veterans Affairs. He states, "Our military members and their families make sacrifices that require them to pack up and move with little notice. They shouldn't be penalized after they leave military service by burdensome residency requirements. This waiver will allow students to continue receiving the GI Bill benefits they've earned as states work to comply with this important law." A list of states that are in compliance is posted on the GI Bill website. VA will update the list as more states become compliant. The resident rate provisions of the CHOICE Act generally cover veterans as well as their spouses and children who live in the state where they are attending school who are enrolled within the 3 years of the veteran's qualifying discharge. To remain approved by the VA, schools must charge tuition and fees at the resident rate to those covered individuals.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health report. Americans are getting too much fluoride from multiple sources, including toothpaste, mouthwash, some juices and sodas, and water, the federal government has found. So the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is now recommending cutting in half the amount of fluoride that's added to drinking water to prevent tooth decay. Ironically, too much fluoride can actually hurt the teeth of young children. The federal government officially recognizes only one problem associated with too much fluoride. It's called fluorosis, which causes staining of the teeth. The stains can be white or, in severe cases, brown, causing pitting of teeth and sometimes requiring cosmetic procedures to repair the damage. Only children age 8 or younger are at risk of fluorosis. Now, this actually happened to my daughter, who had to get veneers on her front teeth to repair damage after she got brown spots on her front teeth. According to WebMD, fluorosis affects nearly one in every four Americans ages 6 to 49 now. It's most prevalent in those ages 12 to 15. The vast majority of cases are mild and less than 1% are severe, but researchers have also observed that since the mid-80s, the prevalence of fluorosis in children ages 10 to 15 has increased sharply. Although fluorosis is not a disease, its effects can be psychologically distressing and difficult to treat. And costly, I might add. But some scientists contend that excess fluoride may lower IQs, cause brain damage, and also increase the risk of other health conditions such as thyroid disorders and attention deficit disorder. Dr. Philippe Grandjean at Harvard School of Public Health says, due to the importance of having the best possible brains in the future, I think that would suggest that we be careful about the amounts of fluoride that we deliver to the population in drinking water, NPR reports. The Fluoride Action Network, an organization opposed to water fluoridation, is calling on the U.S. to stop fluoridation altogether, as some European countries have already done. Parents should closely monitor their children's teeth, and if you see even slight white spots appear, contact your dentist right away. Give children only a pea-sized amount of toothpaste and teach them to spit out after brushing, not swallow the toothpaste. Ingesting very high levels can also lead to fluoride toxicity with symptoms including nausea, vomiting, and abdominal pain. So just how did the idea of adding fluoride to drinking water get started? It began after health authorities noted that people in Colorado Springs, Colorado, had slightly discolored teeth from naturally occurring fluoride in their water, but they also had stronger teeth that were resistant to cavities. Now, naturally occurring doesn't mean something is safe. Just look at arsenic, for example. And the fluoride that's added to your water, well, it isn't naturally occurring. It's actually a byproduct of industry. The controversy boils down to who should be making decisions about whether or not children should be ingesting fluoride in their drinking water, parents or the government. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Corey Clement. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.